Podtacular 358, Sparkcast Postmortem for April 2nd, 2013.
Welcome, everyone, to Podtacular, the unofficial Halo Universe podcast. I'm your host, Dust Storm.
And I'm your other host, Brent Gamer.
And we are here for somewhat of a special episode. We're kind of going off of the normal trek of doing ours on Thursdays, and we're doing a show on Tuesday to talk about two interesting panel/media things that have happened in the past 3 weeks. The first thing we're going to be talking about, of course, is the Sparkcast that has made its triumphant return. And I think the one before the one that came out 3 weeks ago, which we'll be talking about, was 8 months prior, 7 months prior to the one that just came out. So
yeah, it was been, a while back.
It's been a long time coming for them to actually come out with another podcast. And I actually think one of the last ones they were talking about was part of the books. So it's kind of interesting that we're coming right back with a podcast that's talking about Silentium. So it's going to be... I don't know how long it's going to be before we see another Sparkcast. I would like to see them kind of do a little bit more often now since they're not focusing on doing game development so much. So maybe we'll see more of them in the not too distant future. Maybe they'll return back to their monthly release of episodes. That'd be pretty cool to see.
I want a daily Sparkcast. Just like every day, get BS Angel on, you know, just talk about whatever.
That would
be interesting. She doesn't even have to talk about Halo, just whoever.
It would be... very, very, very interesting to say the least. And
that would be odd.
I have to be careful what I say because I know she listens to this podcast.
She's listening. She's like, yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. I know she may even join a live stream later. We'll see. So, yeah. So the Sparkcast, it's number 17. It came out, like I said, about 3 weeks ago. And they had Arthur Greg Bear, who is the writer behind the Forerunner trilogy. So if you've read Cryptum and Primordium before, that's the author behind those two books, and Silentium, the third book in the trilogy, just got released 2 weeks ago. And for those that have listened to the podcast before, you will know that I was supposed to get mine, and I didn't think I said it last time, but it turns out that my package actually got stolen from my doorstep. So it was supposedly delivered the day before I left for PAX East. And when I got home from work, I didn't see a package there. I didn't see anything. So I called FedEx, who was the courier for my package. And apparently there's some kind of service with FedEx. It's like FedEx Smart Post or something, which in turn actually hands it over to USPS, the postal service, and then they deliver it. And it turns out the post office no longer leaves door slips, and they leave it at your door. So I guess between me being at work and sometime before I got back, my package actually got stolen. So I had to call up Amazon, who I ordered it from. They were kind enough to issue me a refund, and I'll actually go out later this week and buy Silentium from a bookstore locally instead of having to work through that hassle again. So I've actually started reading Thursday War since I just finished Glasslands, actually on the plane ride 2-pack. So I'm actually going to read through Thursday War, and then I'll read through Silentium. And after that, we'll definitely start looking into doing a lot more fiction-based, heavy lore Halo podcasts. So I may have to send Brent a couple books to kind of catch up as well.
Yeah, I'll need to catch up on all of that. I mean, I haven't read anything except the first three books and the Halo graphic novel. So
okay.
I kind of feel ashamed.
It's all right. Everyone has their own flavors of Halo. Not everyone reads the books. So it's not something to be ashamed about, I think.
I know a little bit about the Forerunner stuff that I've read online just from summaries. So I kind of have an idea of what's going on in the books from Greg Bear, but I still don't know all the details. I want to read it for myself, kind of get it that way.
I will say this. If you've read some of the past Halo books, like the ones from Eric Nyland, and you're not used to Greg's writing style, like from some of his other stuff that he's written, it's a very, very big change. So you will... I was definitely kind of shocked at first and trying to kind of find my ground as I was reading through the books. So if you're new to the Forerunner trilogy or new to Greg Bear, then it'll take a little while to kind of actually get engaged with the storyline. But it's definitely worth it once you kind of get a rhythm for how he writes.
Yeah.
So let's jump right in here with the SparkCast. So as I said before, Greg Bear, author and writer behind the 4Runner trilogy, is on the show. And then there's also Chris Schlerf, which is a very, very interesting last name. He's a senior writer at 343. And then Jeremy Patinaud, I'm not sure how you say his name exactly. And he's a franchise writer for 343. So with those three, David Ellis as a host put out this SparkCast about 3 weeks ago. And they kind of dance around some topics of Silentium here and there, and they get into some nitty-gritty stuff a little bit into the back end of the podcast. But there's some stuff that I wrote down here that I just kind of want to pull out of the podcast that they put out. And one of the first things off the back is Greg Bear comes out and says, Silentium is basically the story leading up to right as the Forerunners are preparing to fire the Halo Rings. That's where Silentium's story is. If you've read the Forerunner trilogy before, you've seen the kind of the progression of the Born Stellar Didact under the wing of the Ur-Didact, and then you have in Primordium the story of Trakross as he becomes a monitor of Installation 00, and then this last book, Silentium, is kind of tying the ends to the Forerunner story right up to the point where they fire the Halo Rings and they're pretty much kind of wiped off the map. That's kind of where Silentium falls here into place. So I know quite a few people who actually read the book and got it done the day they received the book. So it's obviously a very compelling story. And I actually saw a couple of Facebook posts where people were very, very happy with how the book kind of wrapped things up. So I can't wait to read it personally.
All I can think is I already know the end of that book, so already spoiled. Well, I think I know the end. There might be a epilogue that I'm unsure about.
And there's several other topics in here that they cover in the podcast where it's kind of really coming to a realization of how the Forerunners were acting up to the point where they were there when they had to activate the Halo Rings, what kind of discussions were going on. When they were trying to catalog all the species in the galaxy versus trying to wipe them out. So there's this big kind of struggle between different classes within the Forerunner hierarchy of what actually needs to be done in order to protect and uphold the mantle.
Yeah. So it's more of a drama prior to tragedy with the firing of the Halo Rings.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to ask, do they actually reveal the last thing said before the rings get fired?
We did have that question of the week a while ago, and we did get some pretty interesting responses. I have a feeling that we'll probably see the Halos fired in the book. And if there's anyone in the chat that's listening to us live at the moment, if you've read the book, I don't know, we're still kind of in spoiler zone, so...
Yeah, I guess that might be a major spoiler if you think about it.
Yeah, I'm going to tell everyone to hold off on spoilers in the chat room for now.
Spoiler alert, they fire the Halos. Everybody dies.
Well, everyone knows that.
Well,
I mean, you know that from the first Halo game.
Right.
That's a 12-year spoiler. If you haven't figured that out by now, you're kind of behind a little bit. One of the other things, or I guess not other, one of the first things that they talk about is what the roles of the Forerunners are kind of leading up to this inevitable end. And there's a couple of things that the librarian and her class of Forerunners is working on. And this is kind of going back and forth between cataloging all the species in the galaxy and then also investigating these crimes against humanity. So as time goes on, we've seen actually through the terminals in Halo 4 already that the Forerunners thought humans were this just kind of race that was just wiping out solar systems and just ruthless and really didn't care much anything. And at the start, the Forerunners kind of had this idea in their heads where, okay, this species has to be stopped. They're wreaking havoc on planets that don't deserve any of this. And then after a good while of fighting, when their society starts to collapse, and humanity's society at this point is kind of already gone, but then they realize that humanity is actually running away from the Flood. And that's where this discussion of cataloging everything to preserve it for the future comes in versus analyzing these crimes against humanity, where the foreigners have kind of stepped in trying to repel this opposing force upon the rest of the galaxy, and in turn, like, oh, what have we done? So there's also some sympathetic aspects that are going to become rolling in at the end of the book, where we'll see the opinions of the Didact actually change in certain ways that may or may not kind of lead towards a more sympathetic feeling for the Didact if you go back and play the games. So one of the things that they really talked about in the podcast was, once you read this book and then you go back and play the game again, you'll start to realize a lot of these things around the Didact and his opinions and what he really feels that he's doing right. And they even said that there may be some points when, if you go back and play the game after reading the book, where you kind of feel like a douche for things you're doing against the Didact. So there's this really interesting dynamic apparently with the book and how it affects the game. And I know a lot of people have kind of complained about this kind of how the story really relates to the rest of the external fiction, but I have to admit, being able to see these books integrated into the storyline and really enrich the experience has been really cool.
Yeah.
I know you haven't read the books, Brent, and I'm sorry, but from reading Cryptum and Primordium, it just made the Halo 4 campaign that much more interesting to me.
They revealed that the Didact hated humanity because he was trying to save a bunch of puppies. They were stuck on this one world and humanity was going to kill all of them. And that's why he resurrected his plan to exterminate all humans. Save the galaxy. Save the puppies.
Hmm. There's actually a point in the podcast at the near the very end where they talk about the Didact stance on the whole issue. And I don't know if you want to talk about it now or if we want to talk about it later.
We can talk about it now.
I kind of have a list, like just bullet points. But talking about it now, there was actually a point where the Didact was against using the Halos, like trying to preserve the mantle, trying to catalog everything. And kind of on, like, the cases of, or the opinions of the librarian and the Didact kind of swap, in a sense, where the librarian's plan was actually to kind of construct these Halo rings to preserve life. So the whole catalog thing was to catalog all these species, put them on the Halo rings where they would be safe after they fired, and the Didact was all for preserving the mantle and trying to not having to go the destructive route, and that's where all of these Dyson spheres came up, all these shield worlds. So their roles were kind of reversed there for a little while, where the librarian wanted these Halos and the Didact wanted these Dyson spheres, and then eventually it's almost like the roles kind of swapped, from what I understand. And it turns out that the Didact just came to this realization where while he didn't want to use the Halos, it was the only practical thing to do under the pressure of everything that's happening to the Forerunner society, with it falling apart, with the Flood coming in and attacking. So it was the only logical thing to do at the very end was to utilize the Halos.
Yeah, one morning, an intern played a really cruel April Fool's Day prank on the Didact. They peed in his coffee and gave it to him. He got, like, really mad. He's like, I'm just going to wipe everybody out, okay? Like, it's over. Like, the Flood's coming. Like, I just give up.
Uh-huh.
Let's go.
That'd like, be a nasty April Fool's joke. Would they even have April Fool's?
Next time you pee in my coffee, all right? Yeah.
What would be the April Fool's of, like, a galactic calendar? I don't even know if... I don't know. I would think in the greater scheme of things, I guess realistically there wouldn't be one. But, I mean, what kind of galactic prank could you pull?
Like,
I'm not exactly...
to act. I don't know.
I mean, you wouldn't want to, like, Maybe pull a planet out of its orbit for a little bit and make it extremely cold for a day.
Yeah.
I mean, you could probably do that for a solar system and then put it back. That'd be an interesting prank.
Wake somebody up out of cryo sleep before everybody else does. Like, he has to stay on the ship for like 2 weeks while everybody else gets to sleep.
I wouldn't consider that really an April Fool's. That's just kind of unfortunate or being a douche.
See if he goes crazy with loneliness over the 2 week period.
I don't think he would go.
Missed you guys.
I don't think he would go crazy over 2 weeks. 2 weeks isn't too long.
We'll make it look like the cryo tubes were all malfunctioning. And like, like stuck in there permanently.
That would not be good. Back on the topic of the podcast, one of the next things that they talk about is the revelations of the precursors is actually kind of incorporated in this book too. So we haven't really heard much about the precursors other than the fact that they came before the Forerunners and they supposedly were the ones that created everything that exists in the universe, all life in the universe. So apparently we're going to get some more information about the precursors in this book in Silentium. So that'll be nice to at least see from the standpoint of a little bit more exposure behind who they are. I know also from people talking that the whole mystery behind Halo was not knowing who the Forerunners were and not knowing who the precursors were. So this may be kind of a downer to some people, but for me, it's just really cool. And it's one of those things where going down the rabbit hole, the deeper you go, the more questions you have, the more wonder and amazement that you have behind a story such as Halo.
Jackals are precursors.
Spoiler. Yeah, right. We also see the evolution of the Didact and how his morality changes, definitely based on the pressures that the Forerunners as a society has. They kind of talk about how the civilization of the Forerunners also responds to this pressure throughout the galaxy. So we have Forerunner classes like the Builders becoming contractors and how their role in building the Halos is kind of one of the more powerful roles, and they take one of the more powerful positions within the Forerunner social structure. And then you have Warriors who used to be the ones that were really driving the kind of the forefront of the Forerunner civilization become servant warriors. So there's this whole dynamic change of how the Forerunner social structure responds to external pressure from this threat of humans as they come just wiping through the galaxy, being trailed by Flood, and then having to preserve the mantle, just how that changes the thoughts and ideas of the Forerunner society.
Yeah, that kind of mirrors the Covenant Civil War, where the Brutes kind of overtook the elites. It's the big dogs on campus because the Prophets were getting real, real tired of the elites.
Mm-hmm. And it goes back to a lot of, I wouldn't say civil war, but definitely kind of just evolution of society as you kind of grow and do all that. Because, I mean, if you look at American history, and I know we have international listeners, but just from our perspective, since we're American, the important people back when we were first settling were people that were farmers, because those were the people that were making the food and, I mean, giving us the ability to live and being able to grow the crops that we need and raise all the farm animals that we needed to in order to survive. And now we if we look at society today, it's all business people and industry that's driving everything. Since the Industrial Revolution, it's always been this kind of business push. And based on service delivery. So it's civilization and society just changes naturally over time. And it responds to pressures from external forces. So for us, it would be just the inventions of new technologies, forces from external countries for our case. So
the creation of Taco Bell. Doritos.
And its effect on our guts, yes. And how we become more lazy, I guess. You could take that approach there. So
Mountain Dew's XP promotion is destroying America.
Oh, well. For Halo nerds, yes, definitely.
Well, I mean, it's already destroyed America. It's over, but...
Isn't Mountain Dew the soda with, like, the highest amount of sugar in it?
Probably. I know it's got a crazy amount of caffeine and yellow number 5.
yellow coloring number 5.
Yeah, when I was growing up, the rumor was always that Mountain Dew would make your man things grow smaller, kind of shrink in size if you drank it because of the yellow number 5.
I've never heard that before.
I don't know if that's true. I kind of doubt it, but...
Okay. So, aside from the societal changes to pressure, we'll see a lot of just how foreigners react to basically the end of their time as they know it. Like, they know they're struggling. They know that the end is kind of inevitable, and they're trying to figure out what's the best course of action. Do they kind of try to protect themselves? Do they uphold the mantle? What happens to the domain and all this? So it's really, really, we're gonna get a very intimate relationship with the foreigner society, I think, in this book. Of course, for those listening live, if you're joining us late, this is from the perspective of we haven't read the books yet, and so just as a disclaimer. The next thing they talk about is chakras being kind of realized as a monitor for installation 00. So we actually see him in Silentium, believe it or not. I'm not sure if we'll see him in monitor form or if we'll see him in actual human chakras form. So that's still a mystery to us. But there was kind of this discussion a little bit in there. I think it was like 1 or 2 minutes at the most, where they were shooting back ideas of the Born Stellar Didact and kind of what his role was going to be through Cryptum. And someone threw out the idea of the Born Stellar Didact needs a human protagonist alongside him. And someone threw this idea out of having chakras there. And I don't remember from the podcast if they said it was one of the writers on the podcast that threw this idea or if it was Frankie, but they instantly came up with the idea of knowing that chakras was going to end up turning into a monitor.
Yes.
So we see that kind of happen in Primordium. It's kind of hard to spot based on the writing style of the book. And I'm wondering if we'll see a little bit more details behind that conversion in Silentium. That'll be interesting to see. One of the other big questions, and we're almost done here with the Sparkcast. There's a couple more bullet points, but one of the big questions that they really don't touch on, but it was one of those things that they kind of emphasize is going to be answered in the book, is what is the domain? So we've had this kind of floating thought of this kind of bigger hierarchy of just kind of this information network known as the domain. And if you guys have played the game and if you've access the terminal, they're basically you're accessing the edges of the domain. If you have also read the books for the Foreigner trilogy, you will also know the domain from those, where the Foreigners are basically all tied to this thing through Ancillas, and it's basically they can summon information on a whim if they're connected to the domain. And there's this kind of there's these times in the books where the domain is available and times where it's not available. And it's kind of an interesting idea to think that there's just kind of this galactic internet kind of thing where everything's available, everyone can be connected at one time. So what the domain is supposedly kind of more revealed in this book as well.
The domain is a series of tubes. And you can only send so many dump trucks through those tubes. And when you're dumping all your stuff in them, they get clogged up. And that's what happened to the domain. That's why the Forerunners can't access it anymore.
Well, speaking of dump trucks, you actually make a really good segue into the next point, because they developed this idea to kind of supplement faster-than-light travel. So all these slipspace portals. Greg Bear came up with this idea called reconciliation, and this is the cost on the ecological state of the galaxy on the space-time continuum based on objects going in and out of slipspace. So the example that they used was moving halos. So after the halos were created, they had to put the halos in the strategic places. And as it turns out, reconciliation has this effect where, say, they were moving halos from one location to another location in the galaxy, where it actually affects the status of kind of the domain and other things that the foreigners use. So the specific example they use is the networks that the catalog uses, and the catalog is this group of foreigner individuals that are going around and cataloging all of the species. Their connections would actually be slowed down because of these halos moving through slipspace, because of the impact that moving halos has on the space-time continuum somehow. So, of course, I'm going to have to read the book to really understand this further, but moving massive objects through slipspace has this negative effect on the ecology of the entire galactic space-time continuum, and at points when halos are moving through there, the domain has even gone offline just because of how taxing it is on, I guess, the galactic stability. So it was kind of a little bit mumbo jumbo to me. If someone's in the chat that can explain it really briefly, then go for it. I don't think that's quite spoiler territory because they did talk about it a little bit, but if someone has a one or two liner, definitely drop it in the chat. I think that's all. Well, there's one more point that I wanted to bring up from the Sparkcast that they talked about, and that was they mentioned that the Librarian was torn between kind of serving the Forerunners and making sure they survived or going with the humans, and what was the right moral thing to do in order to uphold the mantle. It turns out that she picked humanity, so yay for us. But it kind of really pissed off the Didact, and with them being a wife and husband, their relationship is already very, very interesting, especially a foreign relationship. And I think this is kind of where their stances on how to uphold the mantle kind of swap, and this is where we see the Didact employ more of the direct force of the halos, and where the Librarian kind of swaps over from to preserve humanity. That would be my guess, based on what the book says. We'll figure that out soon.
Wasn't that also the point that Greg Bear started talking about how he likes the Librarian as a mother figure? Like, that part kind of creeped me out a little bit.
So he went into detail of how she appeared. So when Greg Bear was obviously writing these, he had no visual aids to envision what the Didact looked like, what the Librarian looked like. And he talked about when he first saw the Librarian fully realized in the game, how he instantly related it to the Librarian, that he knew it was a Librarian.
It's like, oh, yes, the Librarian.
And you brought it. I don't think it was
much fun with this. But,
but you bring up you brought up the point where she looks like a mother figure. And I mean, I guess Greg Bear went on this small tangent of that we realize people by their faces, and I kind of agree to that. Like, I remember people by their faces, not necessarily by their names. So apparently how he envisioned the Librarian, and then when he saw the Librarian actually out in the flesh of the Halo storyline, then he made the direct connection as the Librarian was a mother figure, and that she altered the human gene pool to kind of reflect her appearance. So that apparently that figure that she has of her face is very similar, very close to human, yet has the mother-like appearance to it.
Yeah, so, I thought that was an interesting conversation.
I didn't think too much of it when I played it in the games. It's like, oh, it's a Librarian. Okay.
I didn't think, like, mommy, I missed you. I just didn't get a mom feel out of it. I don't know.
Well, and apparently she was supposed to be, if I remember right, one of the more or most beautiful looking Forerunners out there. And I mean, that really didn't come across to me that much.
Yeah.
So that was a little, I mean, it wasn't like a put off, but it was just, it's like, okay, I get where you're coming from, but that wasn't a big deal for me.
I think of Halsey as more of a mom figure. Like, if I could have any mom in the Halo universe, I would want Halsey.
She completely neglected Miranda, so...
That's what I'm saying. I would be so disappointing to Halsey that she'd have no choice but to spend time with me to try and improve me. Because her ego is so inflated that she couldn't possibly have, like, an idiot son just floating around in the universe with half of her genetic code. She couldn't handle it.
I think she wouldn't
care.
She would
have to train me.
Well, I mean, if you look at how Dr. Halsey... If you've read, and there's a part of this actually comes out in the Kilo 5 trilogy. So, I mean, she completely just left Miranda to Key's care. And she was just ingrained with the Spartan program and didn't really care about anything else. Like, the Spartans to her were her children. It wasn't Miranda. Like, the only tag that she had to Miranda was the fact that she was her mother. And we really don't see that many emotions were felt for her until the time, and don't mean to go into spoiler territory, but I mean, you probably know that Halsey's already like been confined and brought into custody. So just before the time that she actually gets brought into custody is the time where she's kind of reflecting on Miranda and kind of how bad of a mother she was to her. So
yeah, that's,
it'd be cool to have a brilliant mom that's probably the foremost expert on all Forerunner technology from the human standpoint, and probably arguably the smartest human being in existence, but it would kind of suck that if you never saw her.
Yeah. I guess it could be worse. Sarah Palmer could be your mom.
Well, that might not be too bad.
I guess she'd be an alright mom, just always out, you know, kicking bad guy butt. She'd never get to spend time with you. Which might be a good thing. Knowing Sarah Palmer, you'd want to spend the least amount of time having to deal with
whatever she cares about. She cares about Lasky. Oh, no. Okay, so Alice Peace is just posting in the chat, Osmond could be your mom. No, that would be... No. That would be worse than... I don't know. Maybe not worse than Halsey, but no. The person that ends up to be the leader of Oni? No, that would be horrible. Halo 4 postmortem. So this was the panel that was given at GDC by Josh Holmes. So there were a few panels, but this is the one that most people were talking about, and this is kind of elaborating more on how they integrated the story of Halo 4 within the rest of the franchise and the directions they took when they were conceptualizing what they wanted to do with the game. So a lot of things came out, of course, after the game in terms of people's reactions to the campaign and how multiplayer was integrated into the story of Halo 4. Most of the things that I've heard is just how that most of the stuff you would miss if you didn't read the books, which is understandable. I know definitely from playing the game that I felt I knew a lot more about what was going on in the Halo storyline for Halo 4 because I read the books. And I guess since you haven't read the books yet, what was your take on the campaign story? Did you kind of feel lost in some areas, or was it just kind of like you didn't know what was going on? What did you feel about the campaign?
At the very beginning, like, I had trouble understanding what the Didax motives were. Like, I knew what he was. Just didn't understand why he was so mad at humanity. And it didn't make for a very good enemy. Like, to me, a good enemy is an enemy with a very clear motive. You know, that motive can differ between different villains, but if it's not really defined, then I can't feel the urge to see that enemy defeated. And that's kind of the way it was with me and the Didact. You know, the Covenant was always a more menacing enemy because I mean, it was clear what they were. You know, it's this gigantic army of, you know, conglomerated aliens that are all coming to destroy humanity because it's, you know, it's a religious belief. You know, they think that if they kill all of the humans, they'll get to go on their great journey, and that's kind of what they're going for. But with the Didact, I was like, why are you so mad, dude? Like, what are you trying to accomplish here? And by the time they started kind of explaining the Composer, I was like, so it's like a new Halo weapon, but it's not a Halo weapon. It's just kind of a, like, I didn't understand what it did at the time until, you know, I kind of got into the story more, started trying to figure out exactly what was happening. But it was definitely more of a, not a chore, but it seemed like you had to kind of understand more about the outlying story, especially in the books, to get anything out of the campaign story in Halo 4, as opposed to Halos 1, 2, and 3.
It's interesting you say that, because he actually talks about that specifically in his panel. So we'll actually get down there when I go through all the topics. And I may be a little scatterbrained for this one, because I just finished watching the panel right before the podcast, and I have a page and a half of notes on this. So sorry if I kind of jump around a little bit everywhere for folks listening. The first thing that Josh talks about is hiring the team, going out and finding the best in the industry, and kind of pulling together people for writers, for graphic artists, and all that stuff. Then he went into why they wanted to build Halo and how they wanted to continue the story, and really kind of just branch out on the established fiction so far. He brought out four beliefs of Halo that they kind of came up with for Halo. The first one was heroism, so the ability for you to rise up and kind of face impossible odds and save the galaxy multiple times on end. So that was the first Halo belief. The second one is the belief in humanity, the fact that humanity has all these things set up for them where they can rise up and eventually become the caretakers of the galaxy. So the belief in humanity in the grand scheme of things was their second Halo belief. Their third belief was wonder, the ability to just immerse yourself in this experience and really be able to just kind of branch out, see how big this universe is, and leave room for people to speculate on what could be going on in this universe. And of course, that's really realized through people's creativity with artwork, with machinima, and other cool things. He didn't specifically bring that up, but that's just kind of evident there. And then their last Halo belief was creativity, which I just talked about that a little bit. But the fact that the Halo community is so creative and being able to kind of expand the universe on its own without having to heavily rely too much on just the storyline from Halo.
I also thought it was interesting that he tied actually playing the game into creativity. Like the Halo Combat Sandbox is kind of a way for players to be creative as they play the game. You know, their choice of weapons, their choice of team tactics.
They create their own
like
experience.
Where you're going to go on a map. Yeah.
Right. And there's just, if you can think of a corner of the Halo universe, they probably, at least from a community standpoint, they probably fall within the wonder and creativity part. The heroism and the humanity is more defined by what they write into the story, but it definitely leaves room for people to talk about it. And I think that kind of influences the community as a whole. So, moving on to the story of Halo, there are certain aspects of the storytelling that they want to kind of pull out and really focus on for the Halo 4 campaign. And one of these things was to really dive in to make the characters in such a way where you could empathize with them, where you could really relate, like you were really in their shoes making their decisions. Having the fact that you were actually living through others, directing the narrative yourself. So that was one of the things they tried to stress when they were actually writing the story of Halo. And let's see, moving on, return of the Master Chief, they wanted to really focus on his humanity. So Josh goes into this explanation of Halo as in terms of story has always been, you're this soldier taking orders and you're going out and doing these orders. And for the first time, you're actually on your own making your own decisions. You don't have the UNSC barking orders at you. You don't have Cortana with you in some cases because she's going crazy and you have to make your own decisions. And this is kind of the first time we actually see where Master Chief is having to take charge and actually pulling out this fact that Chief isn't really a robot. He's not just taking orders. He actually is a human being. Let's see. Did you have something to say?
Yeah, kind of. I don't really... I kind of like where they're taking the Chief, but in a way it completely goes against kind of what that character is about. Like, the idea of the Spartans was they were kind of deprived of their humanity on purpose. You know, they were trained, you know, basically only for killing. They're very efficient at it, you know. I mean, they're smart, they're strong, but it's all about getting their mission accomplished, and generally that involves just killing people or aliens, as is the case. But it just seems like you go through three games, you know, where the Chief is essentially a robot, like they were saying, and then all of a sudden, you know, post Halo 3, the Chief decides he's going to start doing things his way. It just seems it doesn't seem congruent with the rest of the story. It just seems like a weird kind of jumping off point. Like, he didn't gradually kind of go into that. It's very clear that the Chief is a different kind of person, even in the first mission, just the stuff he says. I remember one line that didn't really resonate with me was at the very beginning of the first mission. You know, you're running around and you see the Covenant, and you and Cortana are talking about, you know, what happened, why are the Covenant fighting us again? And, like, the Master Chief's like, these Covenants seem fanatical. And I'm like, you kill hundreds of thousands of Covenant. I mean, not, he hasn't killed hundreds of thousands, but I'm saying, like, you've killed thousands of Covenant. You know, I mean, and these seem the most fanatical, you know. I mean, you've dealt with sniper jackals that look for your head specifically, and on Legendary, they seem to find it more often than I like, but, you know, I mean, it's like, you have seen some of the most fanatical elites on the planet, you know. I mean, to me, the most fanatical Covenant were the ones on Halo, like, at the very end of Halo 3, you know, as that, I don't remember which Halo it was, but the one on the Ark that wasn't built completely.
The replacement for Installation 03?
Yeah, that one, you know.
Or 04, sorry.
They're trying to defend it, you know, while it's going off. They're going to die on that Halo, and they're still trying to defend it. And you're, like, saying that these, you know, possibly pirate Covenant, because they didn't know at the time. There was still a chance that they were just, you know, rogue, you know, Covenant forces that weren't even affiliated with the Covenant.
I don't know if that's something to deal with Master Chief's identity or if that's just poor dialogue choice.
But I'm just saying, like, the Chief never said anything. Like, I mean, he said stuff, but it was very rare when he said something. So when the Chief said anything at all, it had a certain weight to it. It had an importance. And then, you know, at the very beginning of the game, he says something that has, you know, very little importance or relevance at all. You know, the Chief doesn't talk about that stuff. He just starts popping heads. Like, he talks about things if he needs to, if he needs to convey information, but he doesn't just, you know, sit around and chat idly.
Right. And we definitely see a lot more of the dialogue of Master Chief in Halo 4. In terms of whether or not it's actually a good thing or a bad thing, it's interesting. It takes in a different direction, but it is very different from what we know Halo to be before. Where you are this super soldier that's going around and blowing stuff up and just kind of rocking everything. But now we see this other side of Chief where Cortana is falling apart. Chief's having to kind of pick up the pieces that she's leaving behind. And it's a very different story. The evolution of Halo is definitely going to be different from now on. It's a different studio. It's a different writing team for Halo, and I mean, it's just going to continue on this path of seeing how I mean, now that we know if whether or not that Cortana's there, just seeing Chief actually for who he is behind all that armor. And for some people, they're not really ready for it.
Well, it just seemed like a very abrupt change. Like, they didn't kind of...
It was.
Saying I hated the Chief's dialogue in the game. I mean, I liked it. I enjoyed the entire Halo 4 campaign, despite not really knowing anything about the Greg Bear books. It was good. I obviously enjoyed the Cortana storyline like everybody else did. I feel like what might have been a good idea, and obviously it doesn't matter what I would have wanted out of a game because I don't get to choose where the story goes, but kind of like gradually show Cortana going nuts and then kill her off 3/4 of the way through Halo 4. And then you have that rest of the quarter of the game to go through without Cortana. And you get to see the Chief like deteriorate from having a companion, because he obviously cares for Cortana, and then, you know, going to being basically alone in the world. She was basically his only friend for that period of time.
Yeah. I mean,
they bonded.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's just the story's changing now.
Yeah.
The next topic that they talk about right after talking about the whole examining Chief's humanity is the story that they chose to tell is kind of how they relate all the fiction into or tie it all together. Is the story is supposed to be kind of like an onion, where you can have these kind of layers to the game, and if you want to dig deeper, you can go deeper, and supposedly it's all kind of self-contained. But I feel that with how Halo 4 was done, and from talking with or just seeing a lot of people's opinions, it really seemed like you had to know a little bit more what was at the core of some of the other layers, and some of the other layers, and before you could actually get the whole picture. I really didn't agree with his onion analogy, and I know you made a comment about it before we started recording. What do you think about the whole? And he actually used a pyramid analogy a little bit later as well. But what do you think of Halo 4 kind of standing as its own story compared to the books? Because it seemed like there's some issues of contradiction where they wanted to incorporate the books, but they also wanted it to be a self-containing story arc. And Halo 4 really didn't seem to be quite that way for me.
The big problem is that you're introducing this character through books, basically. If you wanted to know anything significant about the Didact, you had to read the books.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to know anything significant about the Librarian, you had to read the books. Or even better, have an understanding of the Halo 3 terminals. If you wanted to know anything about the Prometheans, you had to read the books. All of that stuff was explained very quickly, and in my opinion, it just wasn't adequate enough to really tell me what's going on. They introduced a whole bunch of stuff, and in the game at least, they didn't explain it very well. They definitely wanted you to read the books to understand it. Now, that's one thing, you know, I mean, but saying that you were extremely successful in conveying to people who just played the video game what the Forerunners were is a little disingenuous to me. I mean, the entire point of the books is that you don't know and you want to read about them. You're obviously going to get a lot more narrative out of a book than you will pretty much any video game. Like, even the best video games, you know, even if they have really, really good stories, they generally don't have as much narrative as a single book does. It's just the nature of interactive entertainment, but you gotta choose which one you're gonna go with, you know, or are you gonna say that your in-game story is really self-contained, even though it's not, or are you going to try and dial back what you're doing in the books, you know, kind of lay off of that as much, and in Halo 5 have more of the story actually present in the game instead of present in the books.
One of the things, just taking an example of what you said, is if you look at Halo 1 and Halo 2, you didn't have to read the books in order to know what was going on in the stories, but the books were still an adequate supplement to the storyline of Halo. And just reading the books, it would enrich the experience. It wasn't essentially a requirement, where for Halo 4, it was almost as if the Forerunner trilogy was a requirement in order to fully understand and realize the story they were portraying in Halo 4.
Yes, you must be this cool to understand.
Yeah. So the story disconnect from the campaign was it wasn't very well disconnected. It was closely tied, and for some people it was just tied too much. It shouldn't have been something where I have to go now research this thing in order to find out what this actually means in game. And that's actually kind of the next topic they really address, is tying into the deep fiction. Josh gives two examples, one where they feel that they did a very good job tying it into the fiction of Halo, and then one where they didn't. And it just so happens that the one that he pulled out that they didn't was the Didact. So you've kind of been foreshadowing this whole topic for the podcast. For Lasky, the stories behind Lasky were very self-contained. Apparently, I've just started reading Thursday War, but apparently he was introduced in Thursday War. He is very deeply analyzed and thought out in Forward Unto Dawn. We see who he is, kind of his history. We see him as this kind of kid who's unsure about the war, who ends up being this kind of commander, and who actually ends up taking over the Infinity as a commander. And from those story aspects, those were self-contained pieces that could be pulled together to build this character. They were well-defined, and they were simple yet compelling. So that's what Josh Holmes emphasized throughout Lasky's tie into the Halo 4 storyline. So everything from Thursday War to Forward Unto Dawn and Halo 4, everything was self-contained. All the story bits that you needed to know to fit each different section were easy to understand. They were segmented very clearly and very easy to just pick up and understand who Lasky was. On the other hand, you have the Didact, where, and like Brent has already said, there's this kind of disconnect. You don't really understand the motives of the Didact in the game. And Josh Holmes also points out that this is what people actually felt when they saw the game come out. And there were quite a few times during this presentation where it seemed like he was almost confused at people's reactions to what they did with the game. And I would recommend to 343, it's like you're taking a franchise that you've that has been in the hands of the community for so long, and I wouldn't really try to justify yourself in the way you did it was right, but just take it as constructive criticism. So it seemed like there were quite a few times where he was trying to defend their decisions. And at this point, I think 343 just needs to man up. It's like, okay, we chose what we did, and we will evaluate what we will do in the future. But I mean, just because you took something a certain direction doesn't mean it was the right thing to do. But that's my little tangent. So the Didact, they tried to tie him in from the books. So the Forerunner trilogy and the Halo 3 terminals, that's where we actually first hear of the Didact. There's also a disconnect from the terminals in the Halo 4 campaign, because when you got to the terminals, you had to go to Waypoint, and it was a disconnected experience. So that was one of the things that they felt, or that Josh felt, was an issue with people really understanding who the Didact was. And the other point that he brought up that Brent nailed around the head was unclear motives. So how they portrayed the Didact in the game, it turns out a lot of people didn't really understand what his motives were, why he was this bad guy who hated all humans. And from the sounds of it, they were simply trying to portray in the game that it was just this antagonist that was out there to just get rid of all humans. And apparently that wasn't enough for people to grab onto. There wasn't enough context behind who the Didact was and why he was angry at humans and why he wanted to get rid of them in order to be a viable and compelling antagonist. That coupled with the disconnect from everything else was something that, and we've heard cries about this before from all across the Halo community, but that's like one of the reasons, if not the reason, that people really didn't like the Didact as a character in the campaign.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of the problems that people have with the disconnect between the stories in the book and Halo 4 would have been solved if they just put the terminal videos in game. Just get them in game.
Yeah, and he kind of admitted to that at the end, but apparently with the lack of space on the disc, they had to take them out, and he said that was one of the disconnects they feel was really lacking there, was the fact that the terminals weren't in game. And it was a disconnect experience, because for the past, or in Halo 3, you had those terminals in there, and then for Halo Anniversary, you had the terminals right there. Once you activated it, you watched it immediately.
They so should you put never... all the terminals on Viewmaster slides and sent those out with the limited edition.
Oh, wow.
Like you have to sync up the slides with like a recording that you listen to on Halo Waypoint.
Wow.
Turn the slide.
Wow. That'd be even worse.
That'd be great.
No, I would chuck it out the window. No, yeah. No. So let's see. That's the tying to deep fiction. The next thing that they talk about is what they wanted to do with Promethean. So introducing a new enemy class into the Halo 4 gameplay structure. So they wanted to give this give Halo a new perspective, introducing the Prometheans. And, of course, this is the only time that we've seen new enemies get added to the game. So, straight from Halo 1, let me take that back. Enemy class. They introduced Brutes for Halo 3, and they have the Skirmishers for Halo Reach, and they have the different Flood Complex forms. But this is the first, basically, new class of enemies that they've ever added to Halo. So they talk about their process of really fine-tuning the mechanical, visual, and fictional aspects of the Prometheans. And in this presentation, Josh specifically talks about the Knights. There were conflicts between how they wanted the Knight to work functionally from a fiction standpoint and mechanically, and then have this kind of visual appeal to it. And they went down this whole iterative process, and at some points during development, they had to completely scratch some ideas and go back to the drawing board. So the Knight was this thing that they kept on going through revisions and revisions until they came up with this final version of the Promethean Knight that they wanted. And I think it turned out all right. I mean, the Knight's an interesting class. It can be very frustrating at times, but they say that one of the things that they pulled out from going through this process of making the Knight is trying to have this clear goal of what you want actually at near the beginning of the development life cycle. So they didn't really have an idea of what they wanted the Knight to be. So after several iterations and late into the development, they finally nailed this thing down. And of course, when they went through design changes, it altered gameplay and they had to go and do new animation sets. So it affected a bulk of the development process, and there's actually a list of takeaways, and that's one of the takeaways at the very end of his presentation that they're taking out of their development of Halo 4. The new weapons, they wanted to kind of explore some new designs for introducing new weapons into the game, and during playtesting, they actually went through several different stages of coming up with different designs and having weapons that were significantly different. But it turns out that from those playtests, people really gravitated away from the weapons that they created and went more towards the familiar human and Covenant weapons. So they actually had to dial back and re-engineer the Promethean weapons to be more comfortable. So they turned one of the Forerunner weapons into a scatter shot, but they modified it slightly to where it had a Promethean feel. So the fact that the projectiles could bounce off of surfaces was one of the things that they had to change and make something that was relevant and familiar to the player. on top of all that, the weapons had to be balanced, and there had to be consistency between the campaign's versions of the weapons and the multiplayer side of the weapons. So that was this another thing where people had to have this relationship with weapons and be able to kind of identify what its purpose was just by looking at it, instead of coming up with this new design and this new functionality for this weapon that is maybe very, very different from what we've seen in other weapons. And of course, if you think another alien race probably has different form of weapons, but turns out for playtesting, it didn't really work out too well. And if you think about it, just from a fictional standpoint, if the librarian made us in such a way where she altered our genome to kind of be like foreigners and eventually inherit the mantle, you would think that some of those weapons would actually resemble, or some of the humans' weapons would actually resemble those of foreigners if those influences were put there. So in the end, it kind of makes sense. At least that's how I feel about it.
Yeah. The weapons are all right. I mean, I wish they would have come up with something a little more creative. I don't know what, but, you know, just give me, like, two really cool new weapons. But I can't really think of any of the new weapons that I just really, really, really enjoyed. Like, I haven't... Like, I could go an entire game without the incineration cannon ever again.
Yeah.
The binary rifle is just, you know, Sniper 2.0. Like, here's a sniper rifle, but it's more powerful.
A711 says pulse grenade sucks, which it does.
Yeah.
I think just the fact that you have the incineration, the disintegration effect, that was really cool. I like seeing that effect in game. That was, having that effect in there, I think, is kind of what sold the Promethean weapons. The scatter shot, I think it worked out really well at the beginning, but it's, I think it's just, it's come to a realization where it kind of works in certain situations, and that's kind of what has turned out for most of the Promethean weapons, because we're already familiar with the human weapons, we're already familiar with the Covenant weapons, and we really haven't seen the addition of any of the weapons before, so of course, we're going to stick with what we're familiar with, just like Josh said. The fact that the designs are easily recognizable and relatable to the Promethean weapons does help, but it's not something that you necessarily gravitate towards unless it's like, oh, I have a binary rifle. It's powerful. I'm going to use it. It's not something that stands out as like, oh, this is a cool weapon. Like for me, the railgun is my weapon for Halo. And it's a UNSC weapon. It's not a Promethean weapon.
Yeah, I guess I did enjoy the railgun. If I had to choose one weapon out of Halo 4 that I would want, I guess kind of transplanted into Halo 5, it'd be the railgun.
Yeah.
I hate playing, what's that game? It's in Action Sack.
Rocks and Rails?
Yeah, Rocks and Rails. I hate the railgun in that game. I can never get kills with it.
Most of the time, I can do pretty well with it. I personally love the railgun. There was one game when we were playing last night for Monday Night Matchmaking where I just did not connect with the railgun, but we had a game afterwards, and after that, I was like, okay, I'm back on top of it, so... Railgun is definitely one of my favorite weapons, but you definitely kind of have to have space in order to use it effectively.
Yeah.
Let's see. Next on the topic list was the Infinity multiplayer story. So they wanted to pull the communities of multiplayer and campaign players closer together. So from past Halo games, there's always been a very, very small overlap between the two. So the storyline people, the campaign people had their own bubble. The multiplayer had their own bubble, and there was just very little overlap. And what they wanted to do with Halo 4 was bring these two groups closer together. And personally, from my standpoint, I think that's one of the reasons why Halo 4 is not quite as successful as it could have been, because... there are some close ties to it. Now, they did it well, but I think them focusing on trying to bring those two together isn't something that they should focus on. The fact that they did it well with Spartan Ops and War Games, and they incorporated it into the story of Halo was cool. But I think it didn't really turn out to affect the communities in such a way where the people playing pretty much exclusively multiplayer were more interested in the campaign and vice versa. I personally don't think that effect really took place that much. I'm not sure what they're seeing on the back end in terms of stats, but I don't feel as, with talking to people, that those two are kind of crossed, have a greater crossover than they did before.
Yeah.
Let's see. They wanted to make Halo more accessible and help players find success a lot better and kind of contextualize the game towards new players and have older players be able to come in and realize and just kind of gel with the new system. They're catering to new players here, and I think we've kind of voiced our opinions on this, where they don't need to cater to the new players that much. They need to just focus on the core Halo group, and I think this is another mistake that they made here, where they're focusing on the new players way more than they need to, and they should have just focused on the core Halo group. Now, it's important to put in place systems where other players can come in and enjoy the game, but if you don't make a game for the core group, if you make the game trying to appeal to everyone, then it's going to be a watered-down experience. It's not going to be a fun, exciting, interesting game, in my opinion. I guess Call of Duty kind of breaks this mold, but Call of Duty sucks anyways. I don't think you can have a good game that's complex and interesting and intriguing without being able to focus on your core fan base and really tying into the people that have backed the franchise from day one, that have been there because of how the Halo franchise has developed since day one, where you have this story, this campaign aspect of it, you have this multiplayer aspect of it, and while the two don't necessarily interact with each other too deeply, and while some parts have a steep learning curve, there's always those core pieces of the community that always still kind of work together, and they still back the Halo franchise. But when you try to incorporate more people to it, it gets watered down, and the experience just is not as exciting as it used to be.
Yeah, too many cooks ruin the soup. You know, I mean, you add too much stuff, you add too many gameplay features or whatever you want to call them. You know, you want to dive into a perk system that really has no place in Halo. If you're going to go off of the original core gameplay that the original three games had, that really doesn't gel with a Call of Duty level perk system. I don't know if they're going to ratchet up that perk system, like make it more prevalent in Halo 5, but I hope they dial it down. I hope that we kind of see the perk system, like fewer perks, and you get them all at the same time, and you don't have to unlock them through some stupid, you know, Spartan rank system that, I mean, it's easy to get to Spartan rank 50. Like, you get there real quick. So why don't, what was the entire point of kind of giving you these different weapons and perks, you know, on this kind of?
It wasn't something that was very conducive to the whole experience of Halo. And someone in the chat, Gatlin01, said, Reach was fun, and Halo 4, there is no time for fun and very intense, which is interesting because when Josh was talking about this topic, he specifically stressed that they were trying to make Halo more accessible to new players and to help newer players find success. So one of their justifications behind using the ordnance drop is so people can get those heavy weapons that they possibly couldn't get their hands on before. Which, okay, I see part of that, but it breaks the experience of Halo 4 as it used to be. And, I mean, if the majority of the Halo community feels as Gatlin does, where there's no fun, then they basically failed in what Josh said they were trying to do, which was help players find success. And, I mean, success only goes far if you're not having fun.
Well, I mean, going back to, if you played Halo 2, you know how many noobs would go and get the power weapons. Like, noobs were able to pick up the power weapons that they wanted to use. They weren't good with them, and they're still not good with them. I mean, if you suck with a weapon just because you can get it out of an ordnance drop isn't going to make you, you know, automatically, like, super MLG pro with it. But, I mean, it wasn't like in Halo 2, like, the only people with power weapons were the best players. You know, even if you were new, you could get a power weapon, and that's what made it even more exciting, you know? If I got to the rockets first, I knew that I was the rocket man, you know? There's usually only one rocket launcher on the map, and you knew that you could just run around and, you know, go crazy with it. And you knew... Well, I mean, you didn't know exactly how many were on the map, but you were pretty aware that nobody else had that rocket launcher, and you felt powerful. And now, I mean, anybody can get anything out of these personal ordnance drops and stuff like that. It makes power weapons feel less powerful and overused.
Right. Like I said before, I think their focus on trying to incorporate more people into it, I mean, while it's good from a business standpoint, and it is important to at least adhere to new people coming in and trying to enjoy the experience, you have to cater to that core audience, and you have to cater to that gameplay style that has been established so long, and it's unfortunately been watered down, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So, S711 even writes in here, ordnance drops were supposed to make things better, but it turns out that even with good players, you can't get kills because some other less skilled players could get rocket launchers, and maybe you would get nothing but speed boost, plasma grenades and a needler.
Pulse grenades, needler, and speed boost. You're good to go.
So it's it breaks Halo. It breaks how Halo is flowed, because we've had this discussion, I think, on here a couple of times, but it breaks the natural tendencies of what's been established in the past, where you know where heavy weapons spawn, you know how to control the map, and that map control is very important, where ordnance just blows that out of the water. There's no case of map control, really. So there's lots of things that kind of break here, and I think the focus on helping players find success and making Halo more accessible, I think those really watered down the experience. And while it may look good from a business perspective, I don't think it helps the franchise at all. I think it actually hinders the franchise, and I think that's also one of the reasons why people have turned away from Halo. I mean, the numbers for Halo has been very, very low compared to what they've been in Reach.
I have to hope that 343 realizes that. I mean, obviously it's too late to fix Halo 4 the way we'd want it, but they got to be working on Halo 5 right now. They have to be setting down the fundamental gameplay of Halo 5 and Halo 5 multiplayer.
Right.
And I hope they're taking all this into consideration.
Well, I'm sure they are, because we've seen their response with what they did for the second half of Spartan Ops, what they've done with the title updates, and being able to go in and change all those weapon balances now with the new title update. So they're definitely listening, but my big question is related to the story. How much are they willing to bend towards how the community feels about Halo and what actually needs to be done versus what they want to do in order to make that game that's going to stand out there like a shining beacon as an example to the rest of the first-person shooter genres, and not just be this other game that people pick up and play whenever it comes out for 3 months and then they go play something else.
Well, also, when Halo 5 comes out, another high-profile first-person shooter will have already been released by a developer
Destiny.
You might know.
Yep. Yeah.
And, you know, that Bungie's going to want to get some of that, you know, fan base back, and they will. But, you know, it's a long-term game. It's like an MMO-style first-person shooter, and people are going to be playing that for a long, long time, so they're going to have to figure out, you know... First of all, they're going to have to deal with... I don't know if Destiny is going to be a good game. I'm assuming it's going to be a good game, because Bungie, I don't see why they would put out a bad game.
Right.
So they have to deal with how successful that game is and figure out, you know, what kind of improvements to the first-person shooter genre has Destiny brought to the table that now we have to match? And so they got to figure that out, and then they got to figure out, you know, how do we match it, and then how do we beat it to get, you know, people playing Halo again? You know, how do we pull them away from this huge, you know, game made by the studio that used to make our franchise?
Yeah.
It would be it's somebody making Crash Bandicoot while, like, a new Uncharted game or something was coming out.
It's a big power pull, because we don't know if people are going to kind of stay with Halo, if people are kind of staying there, or, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of Bungie fans that have picked up Halo because they still like the story, but at heart, they're Bungie fans. So,
yeah,
we're definitely going to see a split back to the Bungie side of the community, and I have a feeling Destiny is going to be a hit because, I mean, Bungie's been known to make good games, and I mean, they've been working on this since ODST, so they've been working on this game for 4 years now. So
yeah, it's going to be pretty awesome. No, I'm ready for Destiny, but
yeah, I am too. I'm really, really interested to see what they're going to do with that. We'll still be here doing Halo, so no worries about that. But Destiny is one of those games on our radars that is going to be a big contender for time behind the controller, I think. At least I hope. Maybe it'll be an awakening for 343 to pull their stuff together and really push out a product that's going to wow and amaze everybody. Last thing that that Josh talked about before heading into the takeaways was something that they discovered in Spartan Ops, where players were actually playing more single player Spartan Ops, going in by themselves instead of actually going in cooperatively. And that was something that they weren't expecting. They tailored the game or Spartan Ops experience in such a way where there was emphasis on playing co-op, but they were actually surprised at how many people actually went in solo instead. This is one of those other things where, and he actually mentioned this throughout the panel a few times, but I think this is the first time I actually talked about it, but going and getting statistics and getting feedback of things before the game actually comes out and planning ahead and knowing what your goals are. So that moves us into the takeaways that Josh talks about from everything that he discussed during his panel. So the first one he said was self-contained narrative. So this goes back to the whole thing where everything needs to be able to be self-contained and then everything would enhance itself. So I think we can all agree here that the Halo 4 campaign story was not all self-contained. There were certain elements of the story that had to be pulled from other aspects in order to understand them. And Brent, I think you kind of nailed one on the head. The big one, I think, for everyone was the Didact.
Yeah.
So everything needs to be able to be self-contained and have that narrative be able to stand on its own, but be able to be enhanced by the rest of the external sources to whatever that media is. The second one is clear goals for prototypes. So this goes back to what they did with the Prometheans and the Forerunner weapons and having a clear end state of where they want to actually end up for whatever they're working on. And it seemed like a lot of their dev time was kind of wasted from not having these clear goals and having to go back to the drawing board and change things over and over again. So having these clear goals, he came up with this idea of the interpretation loop. And those four stages are envisioning your idea, asserting it with other members, kind of going through and figuring out is this what we really want, verifying it that the end state is what we are interested in, what we have drafted up is what we want to be as a final product, and then reinterpret. So, I mean, you have the cycle where, okay, so we have this thing, do we need to do anything else to it in order to further reach our goal of what this needs to be? So having a clear end state of what you want something to be instead of this floating thing where, okay, let's try this. Oh, okay, let's scrap that and then try this. Okay, that doesn't work. Is something that needs to be done early on in the development process. Third thing is boundaries aren't bad. Being able to work in the confines of a system is one of the things that kind of helps really invoke creativity and figure out ways to tell a story within certain confines. And also it kind of helps restrict you to what you can do and doesn't put you in a position where you don't overtax yourself too much and overcompensate and overindulge in any one particular area. Another one is familiarity versus reinvention. So this is, of course, how much of the old style Halo do we pull back and keep in the franchise versus bringing in new features, new ways to do things. For this game, it's the new enemy class, the new weapons, the new game modes, and all that stuff. So it's that balance of what has to be in there from the past Halo games for players to feel that it's a Halo game, but also what can we add to the experience to kind of make it our own and invent some new stuff for our franchise. Next thing is perfection is worthless in isolation. The specific example that Josh brings up is when they were talking about the Prometheans. So there'd be times where they would dive deep into the development of the Promethean in terms of a mechanical level, on a fictional level, on a gameplay level, on a visual level. And there were times where they would dig deep into designing that Promethean knight, but they didn't take into account the whole grand scheme of things of how it actually fit into the game. And that's where they lost some of their dev time, where they got to this point where they had this cool idea for the knight, but when they went to put it back in the game, it didn't fit. So perfection is worthless without, or worthless in isolation. So you got to make sure that it fits with the rest of the game and what you are developing in the system. And for this is Halo 4. And the last thing is believe. Believe in your team. Believe in your abilities to come out with a product that will be successful. And just never lose hope that whatever you're doing isn't just worthless and not going to be enjoyed by people. Just keep your head up and just keep on pushing through as you go through the whole development process. Then there's a Q&A section. A couple of the questions were interesting. Some of the other ones I didn't really care for. I'm going to read through, or I'm going to address the ones that I found interesting. And then I guess, Brent, if there were any extra ones, you can chime in on yours as well.
Okay.
I guess before we get to that, did you have anything else that you wanted to comment on the bulk or the main part of the panel?
I know, really.
I skipped over some things.
Yeah, but we covered most of the major points. I think we covered all of the major points. Just some of that stuff was kind of minute detail and unimportant stuff.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot more stuff early on where they actually talked about the specific development stuff and the more story aspect and implementation of things in the campaign was more driven towards the end, and that's what we mostly covered. So I think that was kind of the big point that people took away, or I have a feeling that's what people took away. So onto the Q&As then. The first question I think is a pretty good one that someone asked. They asked about the appeal to hardcore and competitive players. So how did 343 balance the attractiveness of new players to the game versus keeping the hardcore competitive players interested as well? Josh restated that the accessibility to Halo for newer players was the focus of the Halo 4 experience, but that they also tried to support that competitive and hardcore community through game types and playlists that they came out with. And personally, I don't think they did a very good job of that. I think I already spoke to this a little bit earlier, but it seemed like their primary focus was on newer players to the franchise, and that it didn't seem the competitive players were really even thought of too much. I mean, I know that the competitive community is one of the communities that they hold dear, but it didn't really seem like they catered much to it with how they developed their system. there's a lot of things in there that a lot of the competitive community doesn't like the fact that you can't drop the flag, the fact that it's auto pickup, and there's other elements to war games in there that it didn't seem like they really had competitive in mind, even though Josh said that they did.
Yeah, and that just kind of seemed like the normal answer that you would give. Somebody, you know, brought up the hardcore casual debate between, you know, whether or not Halo 4 is a casual or a hardcore game as far as multiplayer is concerned.
I personally think Halo 3 did a pretty good job of catering to both those sides.
Yeah. The equipment was pretty controversial at the time. Even that little addition kind of...
But you could take it out. That's the thing. Where in here, yeah, you could take out the ordnance drops, but with how they had the playlist originally designed for Halo 4, you still had ordnance that dropped those weapons, and it wasn't on a set timer, and it wasn't always the same weapon. And I understand that there's evolution in the game, but you still have to kind of cater to those people. And it seemed like that wasn't at the forefront of their minds.
No.
There was another question about QuickTime events and the fact that there was only two. So Josh Holmes talked about how there's a big controversy behind QuickTime events and whether or not it belongs in Halo and that kind of stuff. The two specific moments in Halo 4. So the first one is whenever you're calling up the elevator shaft on the Forward into Dawn and you encounter that first elite. And then the second one, of course, is when you detonate the bomb at the very end of the game. And Josh said those QuickTime events were implemented in order to kind of sell an immersive moment, in order to get the player more deeply engaged with the action that they were doing. And I personally don't think it really affected it too much. I know a lot of people have complained about the whole QuickTime event things, and the fact that there were only two in there and people were complaining about it says quite a bit.
Yeah, they were just kind of pointless. I don't think they detracted from the game. I didn't really like the end battle in Halo 4. I just kind of felt... I don't know, you spend all this time, you know, clearing out these waves of knights, and then it just ends with you doing a QuickTime event.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you think about it, the fight with 343 Guilty Spark on Halo 3 was more interactive because you're actually shooting at it.
Yeah.
God, well, even the Tartarus didact battle was, you know, pretty fun compared to Halo 4 battle. I mean,
they could have done something with that, and they didn't. We've had all these big boss battles at the end of each game, and they just totally dropped the ball on Halo 4. So, I mean, Halo 2, you had the Tartarus battle. Halo 3, you had the battle. Well, you kind of had the battle with, like you said, Guilty Spark. Halo 1, there wasn't really anything too big there. I mean, you were fighting Guilty Spark. And then you had the Warthog run, which was amazing. But yeah, they had a perfect opportunity to have a cool boss battle with the Didact. And they still could have ended it that way. It could have been to the point where Chief was on the ground after fighting him for a while. And it gets to a point where he picks up that grenade and shoves it in his chest. But still, I think they missed out on a big opportunity there.
Yeah.
So apparently there were some other Prometheans that were being thought of being implemented in the game, and they cut those out simply because they didn't have the time to fully flesh out those Prometheans, and I have a feeling it's because they didn't quite know what they were doing with the Prometheans, and Josh even said that with the Knights, that they had to go back to the drawing board plenty of times with that. Let's see. But the progression system was an interesting question. Someone asked about if there was big controversy behind the dev team of the progression system, what they thought about implementing it, because Bungie really, really stressed on not having a progression system. And then in Halo 4, we actually did, where we had the weapon unlocks. So everyone that I talked to that I have talked to about this is either like indifferent on the case or really didn't like it. I've rarely heard people come say that they really enjoyed having the progression system. And I mean, for me, it's one of those things where it didn't really seem productive, because once you got in there, you had all the weapons pretty quickly. So it was just like, so what's the point if I can have just about all the weapons I need after 10 games? What's the point of having a weapon unlock system, a progression system?
What would have been interesting is if you could only like unlock one of each weapon class. So like you had to choose between the DMR or the BR.
But like, Halo's, you could Halo's never use been. Halo's I'm just never saying, been. Like,
go ahead.
No, you.
I'm just saying, like, I don't like the progression system at all. I think it's pointless. But I'm saying if you wanted to give that system a point, like an actual effect on gameplay, that seems like the only way to do it. Like, you progress, and as you progress, you have a choice between plasma pistol or magnum. You have a choice between suppressor or assault rifle. You have a choice between, you know, DMR or BR. It wouldn't be fun. People would complain about it, and they should, but I'm just saying it would actually have an effect on gameplay. It wouldn't be completely pointless like the current progression system is.
The thing with Halo is, though, it's always been a balanced gameplay where everyone has access to the same weapons all the time. And while they didn't completely break it because you could get the weapons so quick, they broke that system for Halo. Halo is one of the shining corners of, or one of the foundational corners of Halo, is that everyone has access to the same weapons. It's a balanced gameplay space. It's not Call of Duty where I can spawn with a sniper and one-shot people from all the way across the map and get quad kills and six-for-ones. You have this balance of gameplay, and that is, in my opinion, what separates Halo from all those, from the likes of Call of Duty and some of these other shooters.
To me, it almost has more in common with Pokemon than it does Call of Duty. At least traditional Halo gameplay, that kind of, you know, rock, paper, scissors style. You know, if you're on the map, you got shotgun, you're closer to me. You know, depending on which weapon I have, if I have like a BR, there's probably a good chance you're going to kill me. It's all about range. You know, and if you find the sniper rifle, all of a sudden you're deadly at, you know, long range, but close range encounters, the people can sneak up on you while you're scoped and, you know, get the kill. Just things like that. It was more of a kind of a back and forth, depending on what you have at any given time, that golden triangle of combat comes into play, you know. And that always seemed like it was more methodical and kind of formulaic, like the Pokemon franchise is, than Call of Duty, which is, I'm going to spawn with this weapon. You know, it has a set range. Everybody can spawn with different weapons. It's one-shot kills everywhere and whatever, you know?
Yeah. When the balance of weapons in Halo 4 has been a cornerstone of the gameplay mechanic for so long, since its inception, I just don't see the point of bringing in a progression system. It just doesn't make any sense. I don't want Halo to be Call of Duty-ized. I want it to be Halo.
I want it to be Pokemon-ized.
Well, Pokemon-ized may be different. But we both will want Pokemon-ized just because we love Pokemon.
Like, imagine it. You're playing a multiplayer match, and there's these little creatures that you can capture. They'll call it, like, Spartanmon or whatever. And your Spartans have to capture the little creatures that you can play in, like, a metagame, you know, between matches.
Like an adventure like mode?
Yeah, like while you're waiting for your next match to load up, you know, you play, like, little Pokemon creature fighting game.
Oh, goodness gracious. Wow. We have made a connection that should not have been made.
Well, think about it. War Games is happening on a holodeck. There's absolutely no reason why they couldn't just, you know, in the future they would have known about Pokemon in the past. They'll be like, hey, we found this old franchise from, you know, 500 years ago. Check this crazy stuff out. Like, these people used to, like, enjoy these creatures, and they got, like, elemental powers, and they're fighting each other. We should just incorporate that into the holodeck. Like, it'll be cool. Like, you're playing War Games, right? And you just capture these little creatures. We could, like, it'll finally give us something to do while we're waiting between matches.
Oh, boy. So that wraps up my questions I wanted to ask. Did you have any other questions you wanted to touch on?
No. Oh, one question. Some guy asked how much influence Greg Bear had on the franchise.
Yes.
And I just thought it was funny because he almost seemed angry about Greg Bear. Like, you could tell, like, in his voice, he was mad that Greg Bear might have had too much power over Halo canon. Like, one man was able to completely shift the Halo franchise. And in a way, he did, but not to the extent of this guy's thinking, probably. He was like, how much power did Greg Bear really have? Like, I don't know what he exactly said, but it was just funny.
Yeah.
And I don't remember exactly what Josh Holmes said about it. He
commented on like how closely that they all were working on the story together, and they were talking with like Frankie and the rest of the creative writing staff. So there was definitely talks going on between everyone as they were writing the book. So it's not like he had complete reign over the Forerunners as they were, but.
Well, also in the Sparkcast, you can tell that he was working in collaboration with the other story team members. I mean, they all knew each other pretty well. And they were bouncing ideas off of each other. It wasn't like Greg Bear just sat there with a pen, you know, shaping the Halo franchise to his very whim. Like, and then the Master Chief, the Didact, did blah 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 and created the Halo. You know, like,
right. So just so you guys know what the other questions were, we're not going to address them too much. But one of them was about the relationship between Master Chief and Cortana and how that was evolved throughout the campaign. Another one was talking about the character development for your Spartan 4. One question was, and I'm a little shocked this one got asked, but it was basically who runs the Halo universe and who comes up with all the creative story elements behind it. And obviously, Josh answered that was Frankie. So, I mean, we knew that pretty much.
Turns out it's really Fumo Jive. Like, that's what happened to him.
So that's what he's been doing. That's why he left the podcast.
He's like the shadow broker of Halo canon. Like, nobody knows who he is, but he's always sending out, like, crazy stuff. Like, he's the one making every single decision in the Halo universe.
Mm-hmm. Another question was changing the layout of the Forge into Dawn. And Josh basically answered that since it was a new development team, they wanted to give some creative freedom to that. Talked about the progression system, and then there was one more question that I forget that was at the very end. It was very quick.
At the very end, they asked him if the panel would be online, and he said yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I didn't write that down. Yeah. Oh, and someone tried to sneak in the question of, or they said, so Cortana's alive, right? And Josh said, thanks for your question.
The non-answer.
Yep, the non-answer.
To me, though, every non-answer is almost always confirmative. Every time, but usually if you have a reason to deny something, you will. Like, if it is really deniable, you will just flat out deny it. You won't give people non-answers. Now, I mean, there are times when that, you know, benefits you to give a non-answer to a negative because it makes people believe one thing while secretly they had all the information all along. They're doubting their own information.
Right.
But yeah, like, Cortana's probably going to be back. I would completely expect her to be back. There's no reason not to. I mean, people love that character way too much to just completely be rid of her.
And she's been such an integral part of Chief.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's, I mean, she's even more important than the other, you know, I mean, Sergeant Johnson was a pretty important character in Halo. Not as important as Cortana, but he is pretty important as far as secondary characters go.
Right.
And he got killed off. And even that doesn't have as big of an impact as Cortana dying this early in the new trilogy, too.
Right. So, yeah, we'll see what happens to Cortana. I mean, my theory is that we will likely see her again. I would want to say we'll see her in Halo 5. If not, definitely in Halo 6. Of course, this is all speculation. I don't really know anything. So, but that would be my guess, is that they either bring her back late in Halo 5 and definitely be back in Halo 6. So, thank you guys for listening to our babble. I think we covered everything we wanted to cover from the GDC panel and the Sparkcast. We will have more of these kind of like in-depth discussions coming in the next couple months. We are kind of still wrapping up the whole process of 343 putting out updates for matchmaking and everything. And then once that kind of starts to quiet down a bit, is then and that's when we'll start to really get into the fiction of Halo. And we'll definitely have some nice guests on to talk about all that good stuff for you guys. You can check us out on our website, podtacular.com. And while you're there, you can send us a submission using our submission form. It's the green button on the top right of the homepage. You can submit us a question there or anything that is Halo related, maybe a story that you've had on Halo, maybe a custom map that you're working on now that Forge Island's out. Yeah. Anything else that you want to inform us of, maybe that you're doing a machinima, maybe there's something else that you're running like a tournament or an event, drop us a line, submissions@podtacular.com. You can also call our listener voicemail, 240-200-HALO. That's 240-200-4256. And leave us any kind of comment or question or any of the aforementioned items of discussion that we would have on the show. You can also check us out on social media. We have Facebook, Twitter. We're on iTunes, Xbox Music. You can subscribe via RSS feed and all that nice stuff. We do have our game nights that we do on Mondays and Wednesdays every week. I'm debating on changing that now to maybe every other week. I'll have to see what schedules are like, but I do want to kind of recover some days to actually do some stuff other than doing those game nights 2 days a week. So right now we're still doing those weekly, and you can participate in those on Mondays and Wednesdays. So Mondays is Monday Night Matchmaking, and that happens at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And the same time on Wednesdays for Wacky Wednesdays, that's our custom nights. And then the second and fourth Tuesdays of every month, we're doing Halo 2 Tuesday, and that's so we can go in and enjoy some Halo 2 on the PC before it gets kicked off of Xbox Live. And we'll once we get a big enough party, we'll go in and do some achievement hunting. So there are a few multiplayer achievements that are in there, so we'll go looking for those as well. Make sure you also check out our live shows. We do our live streaming regular shows on Thursdays at 8:30, and that is so we can talk about the bulletin, any matchmaking updates that are coming out, any other prior articles that have been on Waypoint, or any other big kind of announcements that have been made. So we do those shows regularly on Thursdays at 8:30. We stream those on Twitch. So a good way to figure out when we broadcast is either tune in on that time, or like we're doing with this podcast, we're actually recording on a Tuesday. You can follow us on Twitch. There's a button, and if you create an account, you will automatically receive an email notification when we go live, and that way you will never miss a live broadcast.
Or you could just have the Twitch TV Podtacular channel up all the time. just always
it's,
keep
it's
it on.
It's not broadcasting you'll, stuff all ready. The time, though.
That's what I'm saying. That way, when it does start broadcasting, you'll be ready. You'll know.
If people want to do that, then I guess they're more than happy to.
Like, you'll be watching a YouTube video, and then you'll just hear all dulcet tones, and you'll be like, yeah, I'm going to listen to this instead.
I think there is a timeout, though, where if you sit idle on the page for a while, then it won't even notify you when a new live video even comes up. So,
yep, time to fix that, Twitch.
Well, that's actually smart
so the
on their part.
So people can sit on our channel.
I'm sure there's other people, or other channels that people would be more interested in. Also, we provide this show. It's free and everything else attached to it, but this is kind of run out of my pocket, and I've been promoting this a little bit more recently just to see if I would get any response. But we do have a donation button on our homepage, so it links to PayPal. So I pay for the hosting of the website and the podcast out of pocket. So anything that you're willing to send my way to help out with the website and help out with hosting would be appreciated. So it won't affect what we bring to the table, but it will definitely just kind of help alleviate cost of bills. So, with that said, we are done for the night. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for those who tuned in live to the show. We had, I think, about 12-15 different people rotate in and out of the stream. And as you guys may have noticed during the podcast, we read out some people's chat text in the actual podcast messages. There we go. So we actually read some of those out. So if you're on the live stream, you actually may get some stuff read out on the show and may be acknowledged. So that's another good reason to tune in. On that note, thanks everyone for listening again, and we will see you on Thursday after the bulletin gets released.
See you then. Keep on bragging gameplay onions.